Welcome to this audio introduction to Romans by Alice Birch. It's been directed by Sam Pritchard. The audio described performance at the Almeida Theatre is on Saturday the 4th of October at 2 p.m. with a touch tour at 12 p.m. The production lasts for approximately 2 hours and 50 minutes, including an interval, and will be audio described by Jenny Stewart Cosgrove and Miranda Yates. The Almeida's website tells us, "Adventure and truth, sacrifice everything for it. It is worth it." He is a motherless child, a bullied schoolboy, an adventurer scaling mountains, a colonizer of land, of people, brother, father, soldier, cult leader. He's sipping champagne at his book launch. He's up at 4 a.m. for weights, cardio, ice bath. He's recording a podcast. He is living as a badger. Romans follows the lives of three brothers, Jack, Marlowe and Edmund Roman, tracing their experiences of masculinity across different eras. The play is divided into 5 parts, each drawing on a distinct literary style that has shaped the Western canon, the body of works traditionally considered to be the most influential in European and American literature since the 19th century. Within each part, 3 parallel plots unfold, following the separate journeys of each brother. The setting is simple. The main central area is dominated by a rectangular platform about 8 metres wide and 3 metres deep, which is raised about 30 centimetres higher than the surrounding stage floor. The surface of the platform, like the floor, is covered by a wash of dark tones. During the action, the platform often revolves. The back of the space is surrounded by a tall screen about 8 metres in height that wraps right around the back of the space, following the shape of the theatre's curved back wall. The different locations we visit are reflected in a wash of subdued tones, and later live video is projected across the centre. There's an ethnically diverse cast of 9, 6 men and 3 women. Only the actors playing the brothers remain in the same role throughout, with the rest of the cast playing multiple characters across the 5 parts of the unfolding story. Occasionally the action is underscored by moments of choreographed movement, and there are moments where objects are represented symbolically by gesture. In part 1, we meet the brothers in the 19th century. The space is dimly lit with dark grey tones dominating, spilling across the backdrop like a dark winter sky. On the right of the backdrop is the faint shadow of a leafless tree. The brothers wear clothes of the period, wide-legged, high-waisted trousers in dark grey or brown, with matching tailored jackets cut away at the waist where they button, then finish longer at the back. They pair these with crisp cotton shirts and braces, outfits completed with leather boots in tan or black. All played by adult actors, we also meet them at 10 years old at a boarding school, shivering on the playing fields in grey cotton striped pyjamas. A grim schoolmaster with oiled black hair and a beakish nose sneers at them, his thin arms folded across his narrow chest. He is swathed in the black academic gown that gives him power and authority. Played by a white actor in his early 40s, Jack is the eldest. He's slim and mid-height, with a sinewed muscular frame and pale skin. His reddish-brown hair is cut short and slightly tousled, pushed casually into a side parting. It frames a strong-featured face, with watchful blue eyes and a stubborn mouth that gives way at times to a wolfish grin. Jack embellishes his storytelling and conversation with easy gesture that tumbles from him like the memories he recalls. He has a calm physicality, standing still, hands tucked into trouser pockets, sitting reclined, his ankle propped on his knee, cigarette dangling from his fingers. And yet there's an intensity there, a tightness in the jaw, that betrays his discomfort or an unwillingness to meet the gaze of those who love him. His younger brother Marlowe is of similar stature and build, played by a white actor in his 30s. His smooth-skinned face is pale with cold brown eyes, hooded by thick dark eyebrows and a serious expression. Marlowe walks with a sure-footed confidence and plants his feet as though claiming the ground beneath them for himself. Edmund is the youngest, but taller than his brothers, with dark wavy hair that's cut short and frames an expressive face with a pallid complexion, round blue eyes and a full-lipped mouth that warms with a wide, disarming smile at regular intervals. He has an almost gawky physicality, shown with childlike gestures and an eager energy, arms swinging by his sides or extended with splayed fingers. At times he retreats into himself, arms folding around him, as though in a comforting embrace. We also meet the boys' father, Henry, and their uncle John, both played by the same actor, a tall, broad-shouldered white man in his late 50s. He has snowy grey hair receding from a high brow, with bushy black eyebrows over pale blue eyes. His full grey beard and moustache are short and neat. Uncle John wears a military uniform of high rank with a peaked cap and rows of medal ribbons on his chest. The uniform is dark green, with the trousers tucked into black knee-high boots, and the jacket finished at the lapels and cuffs with flashes of red fabric. He has a brown leather holster across his body attached to a thick belt at his waist. The uniform is baggy on his thin frame and splattered with mud and blood, and he has a long rifle with a bayonet slung over his shoulder. John is marked by his slow pace and moments of controlled stillness. He stares blankly at the middle distance as though lost in thought. At times roused by some remembrance, he bares his teeth in a savage grimace, his blue eyes flashing wildly. Henry is a hunched figure, cradling a glass of port, peering with disdain and smiling with contempt. He's dressed in a long suit jacket of storm grey, over a buttoned-up waistcoat in a lighter hue, a white shirt and grey silk cravat. In part two, the brothers venture to make their way in the world. Each of their stories is woven through the others, and although their paths separate and only cross fleetingly, an invisible cord connects them throughout. The platform often revolves, and light is subtly brighter, with the backdrop initially uplit from the ground, creating an image reflective of a snow-covered mountainside. The tones later redden, bringing the warmth of a more temperate climate. Later in the centre at the back, a party atmosphere is indicated by a circular cluster of soft amber lights, the atmosphere brightening with the addition of several brighter tubes of light. Jack throws himself into adventure, dressed in a canvas jacket of beige with a brown woolen hat jammed on his head and a long yellow scarf wound around his neck. We meet him in the mountains. He shares his adventure with a mountaineer similarly dressed in a teal jacket with a length of rope coiled around his shoulder. Later he works on an icebreaker with an old sea captain in a brown floor-length sealskin fur coat and white fur-trimmed balaclava. His weathered face bears a hardened expression. Later still, Jack is effortlessly stylish in a mint-green cotton shirt worn with a brown suit with a light pinstripe. Jack often holds his hands up, fingers at right angles, forming the square of a camera lens as he takes pictures of his surroundings and the people in them. Marlowe seeks a similar escape, but to warmer climes. He ploughs the colonial furrows of empire dressed in cream jodhpurs tucked into brown leather boots, a white linen shirt with the sleeves rolled up to the biceps, and a cream waistcoat with deep sewn-on pockets. His handsome face is lightly tanned, and his hair is slicked back from his face. He mops his brow and neck with a white handkerchief. An indigenous man haunts the space that empire has destroyed, tall and watchful, his light brown skin sheened with sweat. He has close-cropped afro hair and a short beard. He stands solidly, broad shoulders pushed back and chin lifted with pride. He wears grey cotton trousers topped with a white shirt that's unbuttoned at the throat, where a red paisley cravat is knotted. Over the shirt, he has a lightweight brown leather jacket with a zip worn open. Another man pursues Marlowe, a left-wing academic in beige trousers and a pale blue shirt, who snatches at Marlowe and misses, then watches him, running his fingers through his grey hair and pawing at his grey beard. Edmund stays in England, no longer at home. He is dressed from whatever he found to set off in. Baggy brown trousers worn with an overlong pale blue shirt, the tail sticking out from below a woolen jumper of thick orange and baby blue horizontal stripes. He's thrown on a long grey-blue wool coat over the top. On his restless wanderings in London, Edmund meets an older silver-haired gentleman in a teal-blue three-piece suit worn with a light brown trilby and a pale green bow tie. The man moves with an elegant confidence, eyes never leaving Edmund's, hands reaching for him, fingers twisting around his wrists and shoulders. Two women enter the story, Clarissa and Rosa. Clarissa is a tall, slim, elegant white woman in her 20s, with long, straight brown hair that falls smoothly to her shoulders and is caught away from her face at the front. She's attractive with large brown eyes and a painted mouth of deep ruby red. Unable to hide her feelings, her mood races across her face, and she sashays rather than walks, making the most of her curves as she moves. Her evening dress is vivid emerald green, floor length and figure hugging. She wears it with high-heeled strappy sandals. There's lace detail on the plunging neckline and down the seams of the slightly puffed elbow-length sleeves. She has a jade beaded necklace and a pair of sparkly drop earrings to finish her outfit. Rosa is demure in her choice of dress. Made of russet chiffon with a pale blossom pattern, the pleated skirt hangs to her ankle. The bodice has black lace detail, a modest round neckline and cap sleeves, and she teams it with cream block heel lace-up shoes. Rosa is petite and slim and in her 20s, with light brown skin and large brown eyes. Her dark hair is elegantly styled into a loose chignon at the nape of her neck. She has a contained energy with small, precise gestures and a steely confidence, and speaks with a South American accent. Following the interval, part three sees us return to the family home, where Jack has set up a commune. The space is lit, reflecting a warm summer evening. The platform is set across the back of the space, with a table and five chairs placed on the far right. Further forward in front is a round orange metal barbecue. On the ground to the far left is a video camera on a tripod, and just behind, up on the platform, is a microphone boom. The live video footage taken appears on the screen at the back. Jack pads around the place or lounges in thigh-length blue and green swim shorts, adding an unbuttoned white short-sleeved cotton shirt, which he leaves open, comfortable in his own skin and of his position. Here we meet Esther, a statuesque woman with brown skin and a serious expression. Her dark curly hair tumbles down her back and is held loosely away from her face with a clip. Her brown eyes regard others with unflinching curiosity from behind wire-rimmed glasses, which perch on her nose or dangle from a chain around her neck. Esther is dressed a little formally in a pristine white short-sleeved blouse tucked into mud-brown high-waisted cotton slacks and block-heeled brown leather boots. She has a matching leather satchel worn on the strap across her chest. Esther moves with a surety of purpose, setting up the camera and engaging with others with a calm ease. We also meet other members of the commune. Anna is a petite woman with light brown skin and a long swathe of dark, bushy hair styled in a side parting and held with a clip. She wears a black V-neck blouse and grey and brown A-line peasant skirt with folds of fabric. She completes tasks with an efficiency, a small smile on her lips and a vacant look in her eyes. Timothy saunters, his pace deliberately slow. He shows off his brown muscular body in fitted pale blue shorts and a copper suede waistcoat with fringing on the back. He wears sliders on his feet and his right bicep is covered in a black tattoo. He regards others with earnest intensity and uses expansive gestures when making his points. Lucy and Benny are the final members of the commune. Lucy drifts in, her long brown hair hanging loose. She's dressed in a cheesecloth dress in shades of red, with loose sleeves and a long skirt. She prances on bare feet and smiles coyly, her eyes widening with mock delight. Benny ambles in, dressed in baggy brown trousers and a long-sleeved linen top, with a white towel over his head. When he takes it off, his grey hair is messy and his blue eyes are deep-set and give him a tired look. Finally, James joins them, a burst of energy with collar-length straight blonde hair, a floor-length woolen robe patterned in black, orange and yellow stripes, and worn with flared blue jeans. Part 4 continues to follow the brothers in their divergent lives as the lighting becomes gradually brighter, with multiple locations sharing the space. We begin on the right at a restaurant, represented simply by a table and two chairs. The large table from part three is now on the far left, taking us to a podcast studio with microphones on short stems resting on the table's surface. When the podcast crew are live, a cool purple light washes over the table. Later, in addition, a section of the floor in front opens up to represent a large ice bath. Jack is reaping the whirlwind of his authorial stances and intellectual posturing. A sombre figure now in a dark blue suit with black polished shoes and a muted green shirt worn unbuttoned at the collar. He sits with one leg crossed over the other, leaning back a little and maintaining a steady gaze. He's carefully watching Miranda, his estranged daughter. A grown woman in her early 20s with a nervous energy and sharp, brittle gestures. Miranda's dress is a stretchy pink and red striped one-piece that hangs loosely at her hips. The vertical stripes make her appear tall, and she teams it with tan leather ankle boots and a matching trench-style leather coat. Her deep brown hair is twisted up loosely at the back of her head. A young, smiley waitress dressed in sunshine yellow trousers, a patterned T-shirt and white clogs serves them. Her long hair is pulled back into a low ponytail, and her uniform is a blue and white striped butcher's apron. Later, she's joined by an older male chef dressed in the same way. We meet Marlo as a guest on the In Deep podcast, dressed in an anonymous but incredibly expensive-looking black cashmere sweater and black designer jeans. Marlo is relaxed, arms folded. His dark hair is soft parted to one side and neatly combed away from his chiselled face, and his brown eyes gaze easily from behind transparent plastic designer frames. The three podcast hosts, Patrick, Paddy, Joe and Johnny, are energised men children with fashion choices and physicalities to match. Each is dressed in a uniform of studied nonchalance, joggers or blue jeans, worn low-slung and teamed with brightly coloured hoodies or T-shirts in yellow, green or red. They also wear box-fresh trainers and iconic beanies or baseball caps. They seem blissfully unaware of the fact that they're middle-aged and emphasise their chat with exaggerated youth gesturing and posturing that seems at odds with their jowls, beards and greying hair. They hang on Marlowe's every word, two conducting the interview, while one operates a small portable sound effects machine. Edmund continues to carry an optimism and joy that spreads across his face in an easy, open smile. He's relaxed, making eye contact with those around him and encouraging them to engage with a nod of his head and a widening of his eyes. He's dressed in scruffy black trainers, sky blue joggers, a white T-shirt and a bright lemon yellow woolen cardigan. The men at his workshop, Thomas and Tommy, appear a bit bewildered and timid at first. Both arrive in their coats, a green and purple anorak for Thomas, and a red and black sports jacket for Tommy. Both have jeans, joggers and T-shirts. At one point, a woman comes in. Marianne is dressed in a blue anorak, white jeans, a pink and green home-knit jumper, and ankle-length green wellies. She has a pink woolly hat on her head, and her dark frizzy hair is tied into two thin plaits. In part five, as the final part of their story, the brothers are brought together once more in their childhood home, and the space takes on a sense of deconstruction. The platform now end on to us, with a surge of bright light spilling out along from the back and flooding the audience. Each of the brothers carries the star they have shown throughout their stories. Jack in a green short-sleeved shirt and black trousers, Marlo all in black with a tailored jacket and a pair of Ray-Ban shades covering his eyes, and Edmund, vulnerable in blue joggers and a green baggy vest, his pale-toned arms exposed. Although together in the space, they are separate from each other in gesture, word and deed. Cast and production credits. Jack is played by Kyle Soller. Edmund is played by Stuart Thompson. Marlo is played by Oliver Johnston. John and Henry Roman, Charles, Benny and Patrick are played by Declan Conlon. Mr. Poole, Ramsey, Leo, James and Johnny are played by Jerry Killick. Emilio, Timothy, Joe and Tommy are played by Oliver Huband. Clarissa Kalstrop, Lucy and Miranda are played by Agnes O'Casey. Rosa, Anna and the Waitress are played by Yanexi Enriquez. Esther and Marianne are played by Adele Leonce. The designer is Merle Hensel. The lighting designer is Lee Curran. The sound designer is Benjamin Grant. The composer is Jasmine Kent Rodgman. The movement director is Hannes Langolf. The writer is Alice Birch. And the director is Sam Pritchard. This is the end of the introduction to Romans at the Almeida Theatre. If you have any questions or need further assistance, please contact the box office on 020 7359 4404.